to Ollie Bettesworth's downloadable weekly podcast program. Holy fucking shit Christ, we're back at last with Katie Lane! Welcome to Ollie Bettesworth's downloadable weekly podcast programme with me, Ollie Bettesworth. Can you believe it? We are back. I think it's been about 5 months since my last episode, which means it's been a full 5 months since any of you have heard the world's greatest theme tune, i.e. the theme tune that you just heard. Unless, of course, you've been, you know, wistfully revisiting the old episodes, as I imagine most, if not all of you, undoubtedly, definitely have on repeat since I've been gone. I'm so sorry about the lack of episodes. I kept promising new ones and then they just didn't materialise. It's just been a string of fuck-ups and lazinesses on my part, but also things like my laptop breaking down for a couple of months and me having to save up the money to go and get it repaired. But we're all back now, enough excuses and sob stories. We are here with a brand new episode. But before I introduce it, just want to do a quick mini plug ahead of the main plug at the end of the show, which you can all kind of skip. We've started a brand new comedy night, guys, that we would love to see you at. If you've enjoyed the show, many of the guests that I've had on have already come and performed or will be performing, so you can see them, as well as myself and my mummy. That's right, my mummy is a stand-up comedian as well, believe it or not. Let's not go into that now. And she runs the show with me, and it's a very kind of nice, low-key, intimate show. There's no kind of pretense about it. People turn up. It's a very small room. Doesn't take much to fill it up. Very sociable and friendly, and kind of people come and do extended sets, and it's all very nice. A lot of comedians that have been gigging with each other for years get to kind of see each other at my gig, and I really like that. It creates a really nice atmosphere. It's £3 on the door. It's called Crown the Knave, because we're pretentious and we like to reference poems by 19th century poets such as Edward Rowland Sill, specifically The Fool's Prayer. But don't let that put you off. You know, it's you don't need to know about poetry to come and enjoy it. We scarcely know about poetry. We just know the one. We had a previous night which was called The Painted Grin that we started a few years ago, and that was from exactly the same poem. So we're really getting a lot of mileage out of that. But do come along. It's at Mughouse, www.crownthenave.co.uk, and the next one is on April 21st, which is tomorrow night, in fact, at the time of recording. And it's every 2 weeks after that. So do come along and check out our lineups. But for now, I am introducing the long-awaited return episode, season two, or did I call it? Should we call it a series? Seeing as it's British, yeah, we'll call it a series. Series two, episode four, starring a good friend and a fantastic up-and-coming comedian named Katie Lane, who I was very pleased to have on the show. Not least because she's marvellous to hang out with, but also because she's quite posh, and I didn't necessarily feel like I was the only plummy voiced guy on the show this week, so that was great. So sit back, relax, and enjoy episode 4 of series 2 of Ollie Bettesworth's downloadable weekly podcast program, in which Katie Lane comes around to discuss three things that I have completely forgotten about since it was so long since I edited the show. Enjoy. Katie Lane, hello.
Hello.
Now, you're quite posh, aren't you?
Really posh, yes.
Mm. Why is that?
Why is... Well,
how's that
happened? How do you define posh, Ollie Bettesworth?
Well, usually I'm the one that sounds remarkably plummy.
Yeah.
But I feel like I might have met my match this week. So it's going to sound like Radio 4 to most people. Is that the posh one? I don't listen to the radio.
I think Radio 3 is the properly posh one.
Okay, Radio 3, let's edit.
I never listen to Radio 3.
I'll go back and edit that in.
Yeah. So but what is your definition of posh? Is it just the way somebody speaks?
Yeah, you've got, you know, yeah, exactly. You've got a sort of received pronunciation.
I do, but you can't call it that anymore.
What? Oh.
Because, well, I actually work
in that. Do
you
have to say pronunciation?
Well, no,
it's
all to do with political correctness, of course. So received pronunciation means kind of accepted pronunciation, therefore is the way that you and I speak the only accepted way of speaking?
Yes.
No, of course not.
Hang on, no, let's unpack that.
Okay.
I feel like we are the ones speaking properly. All the rest are, by definition, kind of various states of decay from...
Not at all. No. What if someone's got a really nice northern accent or a West Country accent or a...
Northeast. It might be nice. It's
the
just
Northeast
not,
accent is
it's
gorgeous.
It's just not correct, though. I'm talking about correctness.
Okay. I see. See, this is where
it might
I'm,
be pleasant.
I hate to go into this so early.
Like,
into
like
the...
you know, when you look at a child's drawing and all, it's all wrong.
Yeah.
But it's kind of got a pleasant kind of to
but
it.
But there's what's wrong.
Well, it's just not accurate. It's not. It doesn't look like a house.
Uh-huh.
Mum's hair's not like that.
Right.
Too few fingers, etc.
Yeah.
It might be pretty. You might think, oh, I'll put it on the fridge. But you wouldn't think I'm going to submit it to the Tate Gallery, would you?
Okay. The thing about voices, and voices are something I'm very passionate about, be it singing or speaking voices, are they nice to listen to?
Mm, yes, mine is.
So actually, somebody with a very plummy voice, well, is probably sort of grates on your ears,
mm-hmm.
whereas somebody, the example I always use is Danny Baker, who I love. I love his show on Radio 5. Now, that's a nice neutral station for all types, Radio 5 Live.
Everyone can relate to that.
And
yeah.
he is Southeast London born and bred. He still lives, I think, a mile away from
I think he puts it on.
Where he grew up. No, not at all.
I think he's pretending.
He doesn't. So he has affected, he has changed none of the way he speaks at all, and yet he is the most excellent broadcaster. Everything he says is as clear as anything. It's very well enunciated, and it's totally a part of him, the way he speaks. And for me, he's really nice to listen to. But he doesn't speak at all like you and I do, so...
Again, you're bringing it back to aesthetics. I'm talking about accuracy.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So Danny Baker
yeah.
does not pronounce words in the way that they're supposed to be pronounced, technically speaking.
Okay, well, the word supposed can be...
If you look in the dictionary, if you look in a dictionary that's a phonetic one,
yeah.
is it going to spell it out the way Danny Baker would say it? No. And what are we if we abandon our dictionaries?
You just used a glottal stop there, Ollie. So
what was that?
You said, what are we? So
well, that's
because, already...
That's because I'm a bloody Londoner.
In it, I know.
Hmm.
But yeah. I grew up... So talking about how posh I am, and I do go into this in my amazing comedy, which I'm sure we'll be talking about a lot. But my parents are, as you would expect them to be, probably quite similar to your parents.
Royals.
Yes. I'm sort of pure middle class stock. We've got a bit of overseas history as well, like you have.
Imperial.
Yes.
Imperialism.
Yeah.
Mm.
Whereabouts? I was born in Malaysia, so was
of
my
course.
Mum, so was my sister. Her parents were born in Sri Lanka or
do you have servants?
Ceylon.
Servants?
When I was a baby.
Were they white servants?
No.
No.
They were Malay servants, and I think back then, so this was sort of 60s, 70s, my dad left London when he was about 25, and he went to live in Hong Kong and Singapore and settled in Kuala Lumpur.
Mm-hmm.
And then my mum worked at the Foreign Office, and she went to live out there when she was 21, because you could get posted anywhere you wanted back in those days. So yes, I think in at that time, if you were expats, the lifestyle was very, very luxurious.
Posh.
Well, I think now it's a little harder. But you know, I've got friends who live in Hong Kong and stuff, and it's very unusual not to have a Filipino nanny or maid or whatever.
Do you feel that to this day you respect people from Malaysia just a little bit less?
A little bit less. Hmm. Why would I respect them less?
Well, because they used to serve you.
No, not at all.
Oh, okay.
But, I mean, the setup was...
I'm not here to judge.
You can if you like.
I am here to judge.
You can if you like. But when we moved back to England, we never had anyone.
You stopped the Malaysian slaves.
Absolutely. We didn't bring any of them with us
no.
at all.
Okay, less accepted here, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, I mean, you get people with... Have you or any of your family got a cleaner?
No.
I don't have a cleaner either. I've never had one.
No.
Yeah,
see, we're ruddy. We're mucking in.
Yeah.
Aren't we?
But no, we had... I had a Chinese I had a Malay nanny when I was very little, but the setup would be that they would all sort of live in the house with you and bring all their family and stuff. So my grandmother, when she came to visit us when I was about 2 or 3, was absolutely horrified to see me being waited on hand and foot by various members of this one family. I think with anything like that, the relationship between the family and the people who work there is totally dependent on the family themselves. So some people treat them very well and other people...
Did you treat them well?
I hope so, yeah.
No beatings?
No! What about?
But you wanted to a little bit.
I was only 3 at the time, so maybe I did. Mm. I don't know. But suffice to say, when we moved back to the UK, I had probably the least glamorous upbringing you could imagine, and it was holidays in Wales, and definitely no nannies, nothing after that. Whoa, poor me. And then we moved. this is not the way I wanted to start out.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then we moved up north when I was 6. Mm-hmm. And going back to how posh am I? When we moved up there, I had no idea what posh was. I think when you're a kid, we were talking about this before, normal is what's normal for you. So I'd never been out of the south of England before, I don't think. And the day I started school was, I think, the first time in my life that I felt sort of different. And everyone, as soon as I opened my mouth, everyone just went, "Oh my God, you're so posh." And that continued for 8 years, especially as far as my parents are concerned, because my mum never changed the way she spoke, but I did the next day.
Right.
So I had a northern accent for school.
Really?
And then, yeah, and then I'd speak like this at home, and it was just...
Was it like that one you just did a demonstration of?
Yeah, brilliant.
Hmm.
And it was just
the most... instead of being the posh girl, you were the one with the very strange accent that no one could quite place.
No, it was... It blended in. I've lost a lot of it now,
right.
But no, at the time it was as normal as you could possibly get. It was just second nature to me, so I spoke like that at school and like this at home.
Do you feel ashamed of being posh?
No, why would I?
Do you ever feel now that you ever try and kind of hide it a bit?
Never.
Did you go through a process of sort of owning it, of coming to terms with it, or have you just never seen any reason to feel any
but
shame?
I think it depends on what your definition of posh is. If the way I speak, I'd say is pretty middle class. But when we were growing up, I don't remember ever having any new things. I remember being bought about 2 bits of clothing, you know, for somebody's wedding or whatever. We were materially probably the least spoilt children in the whole of our class.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends what your definition of posh is. What would be worse?
Do you feel like you have to make a joke of it when you're on stage?
I do make a joke of it now. I certainly didn't mention it at all when I first started, because I didn't think I needed to. In terms of it being called, don't forget, I started stand-up when I was 38,
mm-hmm.
by which time I was totally over really caring whether people thought I was posh. I mean, I just don't give a shit if someone thinks I'm posh. I really don't care.
Mm-hmm.
If I'd started when I was 22, then maybe I would have been more worried about people judging me on that aspect. But now, no, I just don't care at all. And actually, wouldn't it be worse, especially at my age, to start pretending to be something I'm not?
Could you give it a go?
What? I suppose I could.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I...
Maybe if you could do the rest of the episode in your affected northern accent.
Okay.
People might warm to you a bit more, because...
Do you think people don't warm to me because of the way I speak?
No, I don't think that's true, actually.
Really?
But I do think that the... I mean, Michael McIntyre is very middle class and very, very popular.
Yeah.
But he kind of makes a middle class clown out of himself, doesn't he? Sort of, he's so campy and so over the top, and he really kind of goes for that unashamedly posh.
I did a gig a while ago with quite a kind of hipstery lineup, and I felt like I stood out a little bit like a sore thumb. But I sort of made a virtue of that and saying, you know, that I shouldn't be here, and true to hipster style, I've actually been booked ironically.
Your perspective isn't one that you often hear.
Isn't it? But that's quite refreshing, isn't it? So for my, you know, in my defence, as it were, and I'm not very good at selling myself at all, but I would say that my viewpoint comes from me. So if you're interested in what I've got to say about anything, and I do, I'm quite a kind of Renaissance woman with various interests.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, God.
You're like Jay-Z.
Yeah, exactly like him. I don't know. I'm very, very interested in the world around me, and I don't enjoy only spending time with people who are exactly like me.
Mm.
So, therefore, I know lots of things about stuff that you might not expect. So, for example, since I was a teenager, I've been a huge darts fan.
Right.
Love darts.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's fun.
That's a place where you don't fit in at all.
Exactly. But it doesn't stop me from doing it.
Do you play darts?
No. No, I'm useless at any kind of hand-eye coordination.
You watch
so
it.
Darts and ten-pin bowling. If you ever want to see anyone get in an absolute fit of rage, then watch me go ten-pin bowling, which I do probably once every 7 years.
The last time I went ten-pin bowling,
yeah,
I'm convinced that I was blessed by the god of bowling itself.
Right, is there one?
I didn't want to say him or herself because it would become a kind of politicised. No, basically, I got so many strikes that I've officially retired from ever going again.
I think that's a good idea.
I'm convinced that it's never going to get any better than that. I got like 4 or 5 in a row. I was like, I've never been good at bowling ever, but just for this one outing.
Did you not get any gutter strikes though?
No.
Isn't that what they're called?
No.
I'm the same with playing.
I was on fire. Everyone around me was going, "Oh, you come and practice all the time, don't you?" And I felt like I had to keep protesting that I hardly ever go bowling. And they were like, "Oh, you're just pretending because." So that was a kind of a glorious moment for me. It's one of the high points of my entire life. So I don't really want to. Don't say gosh, like that's pathetic. But I do. So she's giving me a look now, and so she feels deeply sorry for me. But yeah, I can't go again.
I once won a poker tournament by mistake.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
In my old job, I used to get invited to lots of sort of do's and things with themes, and a radio station invited about 20 of us to do a poker tournament. And because they had a proper croupier and stuff.
Croupier.
That's what they're called in.
Clive
Owen. Is that what
they're called
in poker, or is that just in?
Yeah.
In roulette.
I've seen that Clive Owen movie.
Yes.
They do poker. I didn't like it.
No, it's a weird movie, isn't it?
It was overly stylized.
They only released it. They released it for nationwide distribution about 3 years after it was made because he had just been in
something or other.
Something that had made him a bit more famous.
Hmm.
So they had a proper croupier doing all the. You need someone who knows what they're doing, and I just had a little wallet-sized card of the hands and the order of the hands.
Mm-hmm.
And because we weren't really gambling with our own money, I just really sort of went for it and ended up winning without really meaning to.
You didn't get any money, though?
No.
Oh.
No, I didn't. But I did get sort of the accolade of that whole thing. And it was almost like genuine poker face in that I was sitting there going, honestly, I don't mean any of this. You know, none of this is serious. So it was sort of like a double bluff poker face. But I enjoyed it a lot. I did forget. I thought I got a bit cocky and I thought that I had a winning hand, and then I'd forgotten that between a 10 and a queen you had to have a jack.
Hmm.
It's fairly basic, isn't it?
I don't know anything about cards.
No.
I played poker once. I didn't like it. I felt like people got competitive. Best not to compete, that's what I see.
That's it, and that's what I'm not very competitive at all for that reason.
That's why I don't enter any comedy competitions ever.
Don't you? Have you entered any?
No, never.
Never?
Never once.
Not even when you've done 5 gigs and you thought, right, this is it. If I win this competition,
no.
Good for you.
Never liked them. I never liked the idea of them.
Yeah.
And it's probably done my career a huge disservice. Katie, what's your first choice?
My first choice of things I love is tea.
Tea?
Yes, adore tea.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not one of those people that always has a cup of tea on the go.
Mm-hmm.
I drink it twice. I drink it the minute I get up in the morning, literally the first thing I do when I wake up. And then in the afternoon around sort of 4:30-ish, like a proper English person should do. But both times during the day... it provides me with just joy, relief, comfort, everything. Mm-hmm. And I say this with a straight face. I think people who don't drink tea have something seriously missing from their lives.
I don't drink tea.
Why not?
I think I miss the tea boat.
But who... Didn't your dear mother sail the tea boat in front of you?
And no.
Why not?
Well, it's just
I'm horrified.
I don't like it. I don't like it. And then she just took it away. I think she probably tried once.
Right. But were you a fussy eater?
Well, it's just tea isn't all that nice.
Well, this is the whole point. It doesn't... When you say, well, what does it taste of? Compared with coffee, which I also love for different reasons, that's the good thing about tea is that it doesn't ask too much of you. It doesn't impose its flavour upon you.
Exactly.
It's just very politely there.
It's just sort of there.
But you can do what you like with it. You can have it stronger or weaker or with sugar or with lots of milk or...
Maybe I just haven't had the right tea made for me.
Maybe.
I haven't found that sweet spot.
Mm. I'm very, very fussy. I almost get nervous when people make me a cup of tea. Because I know
like
they're not going to do it properly.
People that prefer tea to coffee, I have a bit of a suspicion against. Not really a suspicion.
See, I drink
tea's
both.
Kind of boring, isn't it? It's for boring people.
No,
it's also very stereotypical. That's why I avoid it.
It is. It's very stereotypical.
Can't pin me down.
No, you can't pigeonhole me.
You can pigeonhole you, though.
You can. Yes, you can. I just think it's such a glue which binds our nation together, genuinely, and it's not just a cliche that we go, oh, let's have a cup of tea, because we do.
Mm.
We do.
Isn't that a bit depressing?
No.
That we all bond over something as
no.
weak and
isn't that wonderful that we can bond over
tea.
Something that costs nothing, but then is a sort of gesture of welcome, it's a gesture of so many different things. I love it.
I feel like if we talk about tea too much,
yeah.
I'll lose the show's reputation for sort
yeah.
of edginess.
On my list of hates, I've put Earl Grey.
Oh, well, that's tea again, isn't it?
It is, really... but it's adulterated
tea.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's wrong with Earl Grey?
It smells of flowers. I can't bear it. And people who go, oh, I've made a pot with three builders and one... No, just don't bring it anywhere near me at all.
What about herbal teas?
I like green tea. Fruit tea... You can shove that. I don't agree with it at all.
Where can you shove it?
Back in the supermarket. I'm not going to be violent about it. Green tea I quite like. Green tea is very good for you.
Mm. What's in green tea? Is it the colour green?
Yes, it's normal tea with green added to it.
Crayons.
Yes.
Green crayons.
Ground up crayons.
I don't think you're being honest with me, Katie.
No, I'm not.
What is it?
Know this. I guess green tea is just the non... It all comes from the same plant, doesn't it?
It sounds healthy, doesn't it? Green.
Because black tea obviously doesn't grow black, does it? It grows green.
Is
We've
it
all
black
seen
tea?
Yeah, black tea is what we drink. Black tea is builder's tea.
Is that what it's called, black tea?
Ish. Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
What are the different colours? Is there blue tea?
There is blue. I think it's called Nilgiri or something like that, which comes from a very specific part of Tamil Nadu. I believe.
Jesus.
If you're getting really technical about these things.
Mm. Well, apparently we are.
Yeah, we are. So there we go. Tea is probably my favourite thing in the world. Do you want to know what's next on my list? Something equally.
Yeah.
Is that makeup?
That's enough on tea. Sorry, he hates makeup.
I love makeup.
You love makeup.
I love makeup more than people might think I love makeup.
Is that because the patriarchy has conditioned you?
Definitely.
Always.
No, it's not the patriarchy, actually. It's the matriarchy which
Jeez.
Has conditioned me. So on my mum's side of the family, she obviously had a father at some point, but very sadly he passed away when I was very, very little.
Mm.
And my mum was 30 and her sisters were still in their 20s. So my poor grandmother was widowed at 50-odd. So on my mum's side, I have a sister. My mum only has sisters. They only have daughters. So we are this sort of family of women, which
terrifying
our Christmas table. My dad is very much this kind of a man's man. He's three brothers and one sister, and he plays lots of sport. And he's amazing, actually. And it does, you can tell when it's starting to wind him up because he'll sort of have to leave the room or whatever.
Mm.
But the way it's, because I don't really wear a lot of makeup, and I'm not one of these people that you envisage being plastered in it, but what I do wear is the difference between me looking like I've been dug up and not.
Right.
And also as a teenager, and this is where I kind of feel a bit sorry for boys, is when you're a teenager, isn't it part of being a teenager to think you are just the most hideous
or of adult life.
Yeah.
Even.
Unfortunately.
Or the entire, all
yes.
of it.
Yes, and my grandmother would always say to all of us, daughters, granddaughters, whatever, you know, when you look in the mirror and you don't like what you see, makeup, darling, makeup.
Right.
And my mum got married quite young, and she had us sort of in her 20s, but her sisters didn't get married till I was 12, 13. So they were sort of like much older sisters for me, and I'd watch them put their mascara on and paint their faces into it. And I'm just fascinated by it.
Mm.
And I love it. I love having it. I love touching it. I love rubbing it on the back of my hand. It's a real girl's thing, but it's a deep passion of mine, and I make no apology for it. And there is not a feminist argument on earth that would discourage me from wearing it. Not one.
In all honesty, I don't think most feminists would care that you wear makeup.
Well, there is the argument that you shouldn't have to sort of conform, and you should accept yourself the way you are. And I do get why people don't want to wear it. I buy that.
Mm.
But the reason I wear it is not to make people like me.
Because you want to find yourself a man.
Absolutely, yes. It's because I want to be popular.
Mm.
I probably wear less now than I did when I was 16 and I had this sort of perfect peachy skin.
Mm.
It's, I don't know, isn't everything to do with presenting yourself and in the way that you want to, I think?
Yeah, I suppose so.
Mm. I love it. And actually, on my list of hates, I've put plastic faces.
Plastic
so actually,
faces.
Sort of the reverse of that. So now the trend for makeup, especially amongst very, very young girls, is just to cake it on.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole kind of orange look, I genuinely do not understand, really. Mm. There are most looks I can kind of get on the back of. So I can, you know, look at goths, I can look at people with tattoos, however you want to look. I can sort of see why you want to look like that. But this whole kind of orange thing where you look in the mirror and think, God, I'm so pale. Let me plaster myself in something that's 10 shades away from my real skin tone. I don't get that at all.
Is it so people think you've been on holiday?
I don't know. I think it's about what's the sort of accepted look at the moment. So this whole, have you seen this whole eyebrow thing that's really gone mad, where you draw on these big scouse brows?
Hmm. No.
Good.
There are people that...
And also people filling their faces with all kinds of plastic and getting their lips done and everything is horrifying.
Never considered a bit of work?
No. No. I wouldn't.
I think a lot of people get work, but you don't notice they've had work because it's good work.
Well, that's the secret.
You look at the disasters and you think, oh, God.
But you look at Madonna, who's got all the money in the world, and look at her face. I mean, really, seriously.
Is it bad?
It's horrendous.
Has she had work done?
Pillow face, hello.
Pillow face?
Yeah, where your face is sort of... It's very puffy.
Sounds comfortable.
Yes, I think it's a shame that the sort of... received idea of perfection is now if you have a line on your forehead, well, you must get rid of it, because lines on foreheads are not unattractive.
Mm.
They're not attractive, they're not unattractive, they're just there.
I feel like I'm going the opposite way. I'm trying to make myself look as run down and old as possible.
Why?
So I
don't people
know.
Don't abuse you for your boyish good looks?
I suppose so. I suppose that's it. I'm sick of being sort of considered a big hunk of sex meat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We've all been there.
It's like Jim Morrison. Hear about him?
No. Well, obviously I've heard of him, yeah.
You've heard of him.
Yeah.
But he was a very pretty man.
He very much was.
And then he decided to become super overweight and bearded.
He was overweight before he died, wasn't
exactly,
he?
Exactly, because he was sick of being a poster boy and wanted to be considered
was that
a
not
great
just
artist.
The...
And I'm kind of, yeah, I'm sick of whenever I go on
was
to stage.
Was that not just the drugs putting on a bit of bloat?
Apparently not. No, his version of events was that he made himself look that way on purpose because he was sick of sexual... And that's sort of... I'm sick of going on stage and thinking... People going, oh, what's he got to complain about? He's so gorgeous.
Yeah.
How can we possibly take any of his gripes seriously?
Well, that's
it. I am actively trying to put on... I mean, I've got an emergent gut. I've, you know, my beard's getting nice and long. I want to be a kind of hobbit.
Okay.
Kind of a...
Well, it's going fine.
Mm,
you've got very
you.
Nice hair. It's very sort of lustrous hair, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I'm still coiffuring.
Yeah, I think that's important.
Of course.
Yeah.
I want to be like a homeless man who's got access to hair gel.
Hmm.
That's the look I want.
I personally find, I think there's definitely a line in the sand as to what is acceptable in terms of personal grooming.
Mm.
And I think if you live in a nice, civilized country like this, everybody has access to running water of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, have a wash. I'm not going to get you saying have a wash, but I'm That's saying true. Poor personal hygiene is inexcusable.
Okay. Good. I'm glad we've covered that. What's wrong?
Yeah. Well, I think it's important to look after yourself.
Is it?
I think so, yeah.
Mm.
I really do.
It's a bit boring, though, isn't it?
It doesn't have to be.
It does, though.
That's on my list of hates, is current sort of food culture, where
okay.
where we've got this double end of fast food culture, where people... Do you eat a lot of fast food? What do you like? What's your
mozzarella cheese dippers from McDonald's.
McDonald's has mozzarella?
Mozzarella, grilled mozzarella, breaded.
Right.
Delicious.
Okay, but that's... okay.
My little thing, my little treat...
Yeah.
Every single night is...
Every night?
After every gig is to stop by the McDonald's, which has been very strategically placed on my way home.
Yeah.
In Tooting Broadway. And get a double cheeseburger, a large fries, and one, if not two, portions of mozzarella sticks.
You have the burger and the chips and the mozzarella sticks.
Oh, baby. Yeah.
Wow.
That is a meal.
That's a lot of saturated fat.
Mm-mm.
I haven't eaten in McDonald's for about 15 years.
You are missing out.
I'm not.
Yes, you are.
I am not.
Get back into it. It's changed
never.
In 15 years.
I couldn't bring myself to do it.
Is it moral?
It's a little bit of everything. So the food that they serve is...
Because I feel like people who sabotage McDonald's on moral reasons are, you know... They're
no,
to,
I genuinely don't like
they're
the
trying
food,
to piss to put out a volcano, you know what I mean?
Really?
We're all evil. We live
okay,
in the
but
West.
On a moral basis,
no one cares
McDonald's.
If you go to McDonald's. We're all fucked.
Yeah, but it's
the battle's
bigger,
already lost.
It's bigger than
we're
that.
We're all hurtling
no,
towards decay and death.
It's bigger than that. All of
we're
these,
all fundamentally no, disgusting and evil.
All of these fast food chains and soft drinks companies.
So have a double cheeseburger.
Actively market themselves to children.
Yeah. Because they're the ones who like the
But they're the ones
the
who
most.
Are going to grow into lifelong consumers, and by the time they're 25, they'll be eating McDonald's. Like,
yeah, and loving it.
Something like one in three Americans eats fast food at least once a week or something like that.
Living the dream.
Yeah, but it's not
But it's
good.
Tasty.
It isn't.
And easy.
The reason it's tasty is because it's
cheap.
Full, yeah, and
don't
bad
be,
quality.
Don't be a snob.
I'm not being a snob at all.
Not everyone can
how much
afford.
Is, how much is your...
Quinoa.
Oh, quinoa's horrible.
Mm.
How much is your burger and chips? I refuse to use the word fries. And
fries.
How much do you spend on that?
£4.50.
Okay, I could take £4.50 and I could feed four people for that.
Yeah. How much effort would be involved there?
Well, I quite like cooking, though.
Is it more effort than saying, can I have a double cheeseburger,
no,
large fries and
well,
some
is,
mozzarella sticks?
But the other thing I also do not like is the diet industry and diet foods and all of that stuff. I can't stand it.
You know, superfoods?
Yeah.
Is that a thing? Does that exist? Or is it just something written
well,
on
no,
the label?
Well, no, I guess superfoods are whatever someone has done a piece of research on recently.
What makes it a superfood?
A superfood is something that will, in its purest form, I guess, do wondrous things for your body.
Okay, because I've started, I've replaced my addiction for energy drinks.
Oh, they're dreadful.
I used to have 3 or 4 of those a day.
Oh my god, Ollie.
Delicious.
They make you aggressive and all sorts of things.
Did that? Oh, is that why I beat up all those people?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I haven't recently because I've moved on to naked smoothies.
But they're quite expensive, aren't they?
They're £2 a pop. But
do you not buy them as part of a Boots meal deal?
Not often.
Okay.
I'm a true believer. I all buy right. them full price. Because what I used to spend on energy drinks is easily transferable.
Absolutely.
And they have superfoods in them, and I want to know whether I should be pleased about that or not.
I think you should.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to do you any harm.
It's got kiwi in it. That's got to be good for me.
That's
right?
got loads of that. I think kiwi's got the highest concentration of vitamin C out of anything. But it just looks a bit 70s, doesn't it, a kiwi fruit?
Well,
think?
Luckily it's all mushed.
It's something of the prawn. It's the prawn cocktail of the fruit world, the kiwi fruit, I think.
Katie, you mentioned that you had a nervous breakdown.
I didn't say I had a nervous breakdown.
You did. You said
came close to having one.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about that.
Okay.
Because I feel like, you know, we've talked about tea.
Yeah.
And quinoa.
Yeah.
And I feel like we should get edgy.
At least you pronounce quinoa properly.
I do.
So many people just have no idea how to pronounce it.
It's like, so annoying.
Ridiculous.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I was at Whole Foods the other day.
No,
they
yeah.
didn't even say it.
Someone
right
said
there.
Quinoa. God.
Oh my God. It really annoyed me.
All right. Let's talk problems.
So what happened, Katie?
So 2008 was officially the worst year of my whole life, pretty much from start to finish.
Mm. It's good when you can identify one, isn't it?
Yes.
2013 for me.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm just...
Well, I've worked out that my bad years come in 6-year cycles.
Right.
So that was 34. So I didn't enjoy 28 particularly. So 2008 was not great. So I had a really nice job that I'd had for ages, which, you know, I loved and hated as much as you, but mostly loved. And I thought I was in danger of becoming one of those people that just stays in a company forever and never sort of. So I thought, well, I'll find a new job. So I spent ages interviewing and found a job where I thought I would fit in, and I had 4 interviews with them and stuff. And
4?
Yeah. Including one.
Make
with
your
the,
fucking mind
I
up.
Know. Including one with the managing director, who in an hour and a quarter did not ask me a single question. He
right.
talked about himself for 75 minutes, which I should
yeah,
have
you see
picked
what was,
up that
what
as
was
a,
happening there.
I know.
Is you are supposed to make a sexual advance.
Yes. So I started this
that
job.
That was plenty
and
of time.
They said, when you work in an agency, you have your sort of list of accounts that you look after, like in any
mm-hmm.
job.
Mm-hmm.
And you work with a team. And so I was going to be a manager of a sort of sub-manager of a team of 4 or 5 people.
Wow.
And they said in my thing, they said, oh, some work on the Coca-Cola account may be involved later on down the line, but for now your accounts will be these.
So it already sounds like you're going for a job for an evil corporation.
They're all evil. Actually, though, when I was interviewing for various jobs, someone said to me, what kind of accounts would you not like to work on? I said, I don't really like accounts that sort of sells sugar to children, etc. He said, oh, so you wouldn't want to work on this, and basically reeled off the entire agency list.
Okay.
So I started this job with all sort of good intentions, and
although hypocritical,
yeah,
although deeply hypocritical.
And within 5 days, I knew I wanted to quit because I was basically a living and breathing robot of the Coca-Cola company. Which, if you didn't realize, its office, you know, the lovely Hammersmith tube station, which has got that beautiful shopping centre.
Beautiful?
No, but all the floors above it.
Mm.
Are the Coca-Cola marketing company. So it's nothing to do with the production of the drink, nothing like that, the distribution.
Evil HQ.
It's the evil HQ, and it's only marketing. That's
right.
It. You need thousands of people across 4 floors.
Just added a target to my list.
Exactly.
Thanks.
So I was up and down there pretty much every day, and loathed every second. It was just endless meetings. But because I was also supposed to be doing another job as well, I was effectively... in doing 2 jobs rather than just one job that had a lot of work where I could stay late or get in early. I had been given 2 jobs to do, and I couldn't do 2. I could do one or the other, but not both.
Mm-hmm.
And so it meant I was doing neither of them properly, and I felt like I was not very good at my job, and I got very, 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 very stressed quite quickly. And you know, people get a certain level of stress can be quite good. You know, kind of put a bit of fire in your belly and get you off your ass.
Is fire in the belly good though?
Yeah, well, for me, so it depends what kind of person you are. So I'm one of those people.
I avoid my stomach being on fire.
Really?
Mm.
Gaviscon.
Mm.
If someone gave you an essay 3 months ahead, when would you start writing that essay?
2 months and 3 weeks, possibly.
Later or before the deadline? I'd start thinking about it 2 days before.
Right.
and then start writing about 2 hours before. So I kind of work on that last minute deadline pressure, which is annoying for me and everyone else, but it's just the way I work, and a lot of people do.
Yeah, I should probably change it.
So, but I was just stressed to the point of it had taken over my entire body, my entire life, and I was so miserable to the point of actually not being... You think when you're miserable, you're crying all the time and just...
No.
I'd actually just lost all power of emotion, and yeah. I think I was... I mean, looking back now, I should have done that thing of being signed off and what have you, but I felt weak.
Institutionalised.
Something like, yeah, banged up. But I got to the point where I could barely read and write anymore. So I'd try and write a very simple email to someone and it would take me half an hour.
Right.
And then I'd look back on it and not remember writing it. So I was literally going a bit mad. And was very unhappy. And my family and friends were saying, listen, you know, you need to do something about this. But of course I didn't know what to do. And I think that's my biggest fear in life, is not knowing what to do. Sometimes we shy away from things that we know we're supposed to do, but we can't be bothered, or we just don't want to, or whatever. But I think genuinely being in a horrible situation and not knowing what to do is for me personally very, very frightening.
Right.
And I couldn't really see a way out. I mean, a way out, of course, would have been to quit, but I needed money. You know, I live by myself, I pay my own bills. If I don't work, then I don't get paid.
Yeah.
Simple enough. But then I didn't want to go and get another job because I was so, my morale was so low or non-existent that I knew if I went to another company, which I could easily have done because I knew enough people and stuff, I could have walked into another job. But I knew, by then I'd convinced myself that I was so useless at whatever I did, and practically all my cognitive function had gone. So, I mean, when I say I could barely read and write, it was a struggle. So I knew that going to another company was not a solution because I would be just as bad there. And then I really would get laughed at and, you know, have to leave town.
Yeah.
So I looked at my options, and I'd always wanted to... I had friends who'd sort of done TEFL courses when they were at uni and stuff, and they'd gone off. Yeah, bless it. But for me, it was the kind of thing that you do as a student, and you go off and you do a TEFL course in wherever.
It's the same with Teach First. They're actually basically cults, because they take people who have screwed up their lives and need a kind of to be sent away somewhere.
Yes.
I know a friend who went on Teach First, and it was all about new starts, new beginnings. Yeah. Kind of shed escaping your previous life.
Well, this is what I didn't want.
It's like, if you've murdered someone, go to Teach First.
I didn't want to feel like I was running away from something.
You'll be sent to Huddersfield. Yeah. No one will find you.
Exactly. Huddersfield.
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 I like that more. Oh, yeah. Jesus Christ, how unprofessional. Huddersfield.
Huddersfield. I was going up to Halifax a lot, actually, which is near Huddersfield.
Huddersfield.
Lovely West York. It was very pretty up there. Anyway, so I worked out that I could go and... Luckily, because this job was so stressful, I hadn't been out for... I'd barely been out for about 3 months, so I had almost 3 months' salary in my bank account, which was... I was getting quite well paid, so it was a nice thing to have. And it did give me some options. So I quit, much to their astonishment. They were genuinely surprised that I left, having told them that I was very unhappy and them not doing anything about it. And I packed up my whole house, which took a fucking long time if you're a bit of a messy person like me. I sold a lot of my possessions on eBay, which has since become a very pleasurable pastime for me. And within 2 months, I was on a plane to Spain, where I did a TEFL course in Seville for a month.
Oh my God.
And that's where they... I mean, you can do it in lots of different ways. You can do it as part of the Open University. You can do it over a course of a year, but I did it intensively for a month, and I was quite nervous because my actually before that, when I was still in London and packing up, I went back to temping, which is something I hadn't done since I was about 20, and temping is absolutely brilliant. I recommend, the best thing I ever did in my whole life, and this is very sad, was learn to type properly.
Right.
Can you touch type?
Yeah.
It's amazing, and it's very easy to learn, and once you learn the technique, you'll never go back to typing with two fingers. And it meant that I could go in the summer holidays from working in awful places around where my parents lived to temping in London and getting paid at the time, I think, 10 quid an hour, which is a lot more than the 3 quid an hour I was getting. So I went back to temping, and just sort of being an office dolly bird. I don't mean that at all.
Dolly bird?
No. Erase that. The temp girl that comes in to sort of fill a space of someone useful who's gone on holiday. It's very, very unchallenging. And a friend of mine said to me, because I was basically just sort of typing letters and making cups of tea, and a friend of mine said to me, isn't that a bit sort of beneath you?
Yeah.
I said, at the moment, no, it's all I'm capable of, really. And it was earning me money and getting me out of the house every day. Otherwise, I think I would have gone insane. So I went off to Spain to do this course for a month, and I was quite nervous about getting back into some kind of academic situation, because it does involve writing essays and preparing stuff. But actually, it was just what I needed to be in one place for a month. I went back and forth between the flat and the school. I met some new people. I was lucky enough to be put into a flat with someone I adored, because that was another very big risk, is having to share a flat again, having lived by myself for so long. I don't enjoy sharing flats with people. And it all worked out very well. And I intended to stay there for 6 months, and I ended up staying for 3 years. Just because I enjoyed being in a new environment. But if you'd have said to me even 3 months previously that
in Spain,
you
literally ran away to Spain.
I did. I lived in Seville for 2 years, and then I moved to Madrid and lived there for a year. And it's quite nice.
You speak Spanish?
Yeah, I do now. I didn't when I got there, and it's quite nice having the freedom to be able to do that. And a lot of people, you know, when they're in terrible situations, be it through work or through debt or whatever, but they've got families to support and what have you, they just don't have the choice of being able to go, I know, I'll just bugger off and go and do what I want. So I was very grateful for having that freedom to be able to just kind of throw everything in and go and start somewhere else. But if you'd have said to me 3 months previously you'll end up living in Spain, I would have it just was never ever in my agenda.
It's like running away to the circus.
Ever, almost, except I'm not very good at cartwheels or you know, handstands or anything. So, and it just sort of opened up a whole new way of working, a whole new way of thinking. I was a lot more relaxed. I lived in my first year, I was earning €1,000 a month, which is the least money I think I've, well, the least money I'd earned in full-time work anyway. But I managed to get by on that. You know, you just make the necessary changes and you learn to live by your means.
Slumming it a little bit.
Not really, because, in fact, the total opposite, because southern Spain is so cheap. You can eat out for €7 or €8. So I was eating out probably 5 or 6 times a week, more than I do here.
Right.
And it's a very, very nice lifestyle. However, it does get a bit limiting after a while. It just seems like you miss your friends and family and things. But going back to the whole, is Tefl a cult? The people I worked with fell into 3 definite categories. People who had left school or uni and were almost unemployable in any situation and didn't know what they wanted to do, so went and did TEFL. People like me in their 30s who had done something else and had lost their way or just wanted to change or burnt out, And then people who had gone to live in Spain and met some dastardly Spaniard and wanted to stay and live with said Spaniard and needed a job.
Murdered someone back in England.
Definitely, yes. There are at least 3 murderers in my school. So I was very lucky. The school I worked in had people from all different areas. We had someone who had been a policewoman, someone who'd worked in the music industry, all kinds of people. But quite often it does attract real weirdos, yeah.
Mm. And those are the people teaching English as a foreign language?
Quite often, yes. So it definitely gave me a whole new life, I guess. But the moral of the story is that you don't have to decide what you want to do by the time you're 25 or 30, and huge changes can happen in your life when you least expect it.
This has been quite an uplifting and life-affirming story of a nervous breakdown.
Thank you.
It's not what I was expecting or hoping for, I'm afraid.
Really? Well, what were you expecting? Were you expecting tears and tantrums?
I was hoping for it, yeah.
Things I didn't really... I think when you're in that place, in that very sort of dark, rock-bottomy place, you lose any ability to think rationally. And you just kind of exist day to day. So I'd go to bed in the evening knowing already that the following day was going to be stressful and dreading. So I'd go to bed and dread waking up before I'd even gone to bed, that sort of thing. And I was, you know, people say, oh, I'm tired. I discovered whole new levels of tiredness that I didn't even know a human body could take. Because I was sort of mentally and emotionally tired as well. And it's only a job. And you know, it's an old cliche, but I wasn't in any kind of job where I was saving lives or changing the world or anything. It was all the stuff that I was being asked to be stressed about was stuff that, in my opinion, just did not matter.
Yeah.
But there are people who didn't agree that it didn't matter. So I had to shape up or ship out.
I remember when I was working for Avalon, being forwarded, secretly being forwarded, an email stream from a producer who'd sent an email to the runner on a production. And it basically said, because it was on that production, it was the rule that you had to ask every single person on the team if they wanted a tea or coffee on the hour, every hour.
Okay.
And this email was like, I noticed that Martin didn't have a coffee at 11:03 this morning, and I don't think you asked him if he wanted a refill, and this is a severe dereliction of duty. I was like, Jesus Christ.
That's terrible.
The programme that you're making is so inconsequential. Again, you're not saving lives. Even if you were saving lives, this would be fucking ridiculous.
Someone once said to me when I was very new in my ad job, he said, to be good at this job, you have to care. Not just about something. Because you're being... I'm not very good at caring about stuff that I don't care about.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it?
And I was just too... too stroppy to...
Too stubborn.
I'm not particularly stubborn, but if I don't think something is important, I'm not going to throw valuable energy at something I don't think is worth it.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of people, that attitude is not tolerable, because you should care about everything. You should give everything 110%, Ollie. Mm. But I think you have to prioritise, and there are some things that are important and there are some things that are just not. So there we go. So my happiness and well-being at the time was much more important than me satisfying a whole raft of marketing executives.
It's very selfish and unprofessional.
I know, it's terrible.
To finish, Katie.
Yes.
Why do you do comedy?
Why do I do it? I think the question is, why do I keep doing it? And I keep doing it because I enjoy it. I've found you. The conversation we had before, you said you'd made peace with it. You found your sort of
reason to be,
your level. And I've definitely found that. A year ago, I was very, very ready to quit.
Really? Why?
Yeah, because it was making me miserable.
Why?
Because I thought I was shit.
Right.
I really genuinely thought I was so, so bad. And you were asking me earlier about where is my place in the sort of comedy land. And at that time, I thought I genuinely didn't have one, because I wasn't this or I wasn't that, or I was too old or I was too posh or I was too boring.
Mm.
And so I thought, well, what's the... Oh, no, I really don't see the point in doing comedy if it makes you miserable.
Yeah.
And there are so many people where they just grind themselves into this little powder of misery, and they take it too seriously, because I think you should take anything you enjoy seriously. But everybody comes at it from the angle of, you know, when am I going to be successful? If you go into any park on a Sunday and see a whole gang of people playing football or playing tennis on the tennis courts, how many of them are ever going to play at Wimbledon or Wembley? None of them.
Hmm.
But should they stop doing it because of that? No.
No.
So I think it's all about finding a level at which you are comfortable. Personally, I don't like doing the gigs where it's always the same people, it's always the same clique of people. That's not for me personally. However, if there are those people that only ever do those gigs because they want to go and see their friends, then great. It's like it's like going to the same pub every Sunday because you know that you'll know half the people in the bar. Why not?
Yeah.
But it's my choice as to whether I want to do those gigs or not. But I think people can really wind themselves into a ball over the whole thing. And, yeah. and they don't really step back and think, why am I doing this? Am I doing this because it makes me happy? Mm-hmm. And for most of us, you know, we should admit it's a hobby. For me, it's a hobby, albeit one where I can maybe make steps towards it being a little more serious in terms of, you know, I might get paid 10 quid or 20 quid every now and again.
Yeah.
To do it, and that's very nice, but that's certainly not why I do it. And the reason I do it is because I love the writing, I love the performing, and now I always think the best thing and the worst thing about anything is the people. Mm. And I'm still, even 2.5 years later, I'm genuinely surprised and gladdened by how many people there are that I see regularly, be it in gigs or quite often now more so outside of gigs, that I really care about and that I like and that make me happy, that I find interesting. Mm. And I like the broad mix of people that you get. So if you go to any night, you know, sort of non-pro night, you will see, you know, here we are, you're a 28-year-old man, I'm a 40-year-old woman. You'll then get a 19-year-old student. You'll then get a woman of, you'll get so many different people who would otherwise never ever be in the same room together.
Mm.
And I love that. I like being around people who are not like me, not all the time, but you know, most of the time I'm interested in other people. I'm an avid people watcher.
Mm.
And so for that reason I love being around lots and lots of different people, and also the behavior aspect. You know, we've talked about the sociopathic side of how but I love watching how comedians behave. Sometimes yeah. it infuriates me, but it's a great platform if you like looking at how people interact with each other, mm-hmm. and with this sort of medium, because a lot of comedians don't. I think a lot of comedians miss the point that it is about how you interact with other comedians. Sure, it's a solo art form unless you're in a sketch group.
Mm.
But watching other people is half of the educational process.
Yeah.
How are you ever to know what's hacky or what's a bad way to do things unless you watch other people a lot?
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoy watching other people. I love watching other people get better. Yeah.
Well, this is all very positive.
It has to be, don't you think? Why would you do something week in, week out that makes you miserable?
I don't know. I mean, that's what I had to figure out when you talk about the phrase. It seems very simple, but the phrase that I always come back to is that it's meant to be fun.
It's meant
to be something. And if I go on stage with a sense of foreboding or dread that it's not going to go well, then it actually does, it goes less well, because I am not on stage feeling like I'm meant to provide fun and be fun.
Yeah.
And I find that even if I'm talking about stuff which is a bit depressing or a bit bleak, as long as I go in with a sense of it, actually this is fun, it kind of works. Whereas if you deliver stuff about depression in a way that seems quite depressed, then, you know, it's it's a tough sell. So not only is my attitude better, but my comedy is better.
Mm.
My performances are better if I take it less seriously.
Mm.
And I find that if I'm doing a gig and it's going well, it just gets better and better and better from there. If my first joke gets a nice big laugh and I feel accepted by the audience, I go from strength to strength in that set. Whereas if the first thing doesn't get a laugh or it feels a bit awkward, I get steadily worse. Because I lose my confidence, I lose my way.
Yeah, losing your confidence is gutting.
I feel like you can do more or less anything on stage and get away with it as long as you perform and behave the entire time as though you belong on stage.
Yeah.
I've seen people that, and I feel like everyone in this room has got the impression that that performer is really good, or at least it wasn't kind of shameful what they did on stage. Yeah. Even though actually when you look at it, they didn't get many laughs. The difference is that they did so with such kind of confidence and warmth that you kind of forgive it, because what you really want is to be engaged by somebody. Mm. And if they can make you really laugh, and obviously that's great, but I feel like people can get away with a lot with just acting like, yeah, they didn't laugh, but who fucking cares?
Mm.
Someone who kind of looks a bit upset that they haven't got a laugh, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse.
Or the old classic telling off the audience for not laughing. That's again, always a favourite.
Yeah, but then I feel like that's something that people do badly. I think there are ways of doing that that sort of brings the audience back or lets them know that we're on the same page. Because I feel like it can be a poison chalice, really, in that if you just sort of continue as though you haven't noticed how bad or stinky that last bit was, sometimes they're going, hang on, this guy doesn't seem to quite realise he's lost us. So saying a quick thing about how it's dipped or how that last bit didn't go,
I think
so
you can make reference to the fact that they haven't laughed and sort of bring it back on yourself, but telling the audience off, or even worse, saying, oh, that joke usually works, or...
Oh, no, never say that.
Because what you're saying is you're revealing the fact that you perform that joke a lot to other audiences, and of course, you know, all audiences know that you don't write a specific set just for that one night, but they don't want to think of it as something that you're just repeating over and over. They want to feel like it's just coming from you, fresh and on the spot. So no, don't ever to tell the audience off or.
But again, look down there are on them. Again. I'm always loath to say, don't do a thing, because whenever I say don't do a thing, I then go to a gig and someone's done that very thing and made it very funny. Another thing that I've noticed a lot of people mentioning online dating as like, oh my God, they talk about online dating. And I understand that, but it isn't because online dating isn't funny. It's because a lot of people have done shit material about online dating.
You've got to be really confident in your online dating material.
I used to have an online dating joke and I've sort of stopped doing it because of that prejudice. It wasn't strong enough to justify, I suppose. That's probably more reason. It's not really that there are hack subjects, there are just hacks.
But also, if you think how many comedians talk about sex and relationships and stuff, it's a lot of them. So therefore, if Tinder is now the principal way that people under 30 or even over 30 meets members of the opposite sex or the same sex, isn't that really a big part of fabric of your...
I do a bit that is about, I was on Facebook, blah, blah, blah. And usually I would go, oh my God, fucking, he's going to talk about Facebook, how boring. But to ignore Facebook is ridiculous.
But give me a cheer if you're on Facebook.
No, of course. But that's not to do with Facebook, that's to do with a hack.
That's to do with education. I saw a girl... a few months ago, she was on her like second or third gig, and she was I think she was Russian or whatever, but she was definitely from a very underrepresented demographic of whatever in comedy. And I thought, and she came on stage and she went, who here is on Facebook? And I was just like, Jesus Christ, there are so many other things that you could have talked about that no other comedian could have talked about, and yet you went for that. But that's all the learning process, isn't it? And the stuff that you think is brilliant, maybe other people have had the same idea. I don't know. But I enjoy it. And I've sort of got to a level where I am doing... I know how many gigs I want to do, which is actually far fewer gigs than I was doing this time last year.
Well, that's the natural progression, I think. A lot of people, when they first start, they do every gig.
But that's good
gig. Yeah, of course it is, yeah. That's a very important part of starting out.
Absolutely.
To learn how the circuit goes.
I think stage time is always important wherever you're at, but especially in the beginning, and just, you know, I can only really talk about my own experience, but I was doing so much new material at the beginning that I needed to do 4 gigs a week just to kind of spit out, and of course there's only 5 minute slots, just to kind of spit out all this rubbish I'd churned out on the bus into my notepad. I needed the stage time to do that, but now I'm thinking, okay, what is this gig now? Is it a new material gig? Is it a I hate the word progression, hate it, but is it a gig I've never done before? Is it in a place I've never done before, and also gigging with comedians that I haven't previously gigged with is always quite exciting. But just sort of going through the motions over and over again, I think, can get quite tedious.
Well, again, it's important to figure out why on earth you're doing it.
Yeah, that's what everybody needs to ask themselves. Why am I doing this? And all of us will have a different answer. But, you know, the people who say, why am I doing this? Because I want to be a famous comedian. I think you should really sort of
another reason. I would not like to be a famous comedian.
Nor would I.
I think in my wildest dreams, I think I would like to be a very, very niche underrated, underrepresented comedian.
Unappreciated.
With a tiny little audience of people that
who just constantly complain how unappreciated you are and...
No, but also that the fact that they like me makes them feel a little bit special. A little bit like they like something that not everyone likes.
Right.
And then, after that, I would like to completely sell out, just to completely destroy those people who believed with me early on and make them not like me anymore.
So they could criticise you for selling out.
Yeah, so I can give them the whole experience. The falling in love with an act and then the disillusionment.
Then you'll be giving away all your material free on iTunes.
I've become the U2 of comedy.
Yeah, they became the U2 of music a long time ago, didn't they?
It is remarkable how much that backfired, that whole marketing.
I know.
It's a huge PR disaster for them, really.
But I cannot understand in whose universe it was a good idea.
They thought they were being nice.
But also,
and generous.
if you're U2, do you really care 25 years or 30 years on if you're still relevant anymore?
Well, apparently.
Are you really that desperate after, I think it's 30, they started very late 70s, so let's say 35 years. Surely you could have just got over yourselves by now.
Also, the rock band tying themselves so completely in with Apple. I mean, that's not rock, is it?
Nah.
No. It's not rock and roll.
Not at all.
You should be storming the Apple offices and kicking over printers.
Yeah.
Spitting on the receptionist.
Absolutely. Or at least, putting the wrong charger in the wrong hole.
Defecating in the photocopier.
Oof, they don't have photocopies at Apple.
What?
I'm sure they don't. I've just made that up, but I'd like to think that Apple did not have regular office equipment.
Everyone needs photocopiers.
Really? Do you think Apple have got like a plastic kettle and a fridge with loads of do not touch food in it?
What do you think they have?
I
cyber foods.
I don't know.
Liquid foods like NASA.
Well, you hear of all these Silicon Valley offices are all like sort of space age, new world offices with cows grazing in the reception and stuff like that.
But I suppose that's a lot of PR, isn't it? It's meant to look like a
fun
place to work.
Also, it's...
Like the Pixar offices.
Yeah, and the Google offices, well, all of them now have things like on-site laundry, doctors, hairdressers. And whilst it is all presented as, hey, guys, this is such a fun, informal place to work, really what they're doing is saying, never leave this office. So if you can do all of your supposedly out-of-work chores, like get your hair cut, do your washing, on the office premises, technically you never, ever have to leave work.
Yeah.
That's what they do.
And that's why there's no excuse. That's why you need to get a dog.
Really? Oh, but they have dog walking facilities.
Do they?
And if you are the boss of, it was either I think it was the Yahoo woman, not Sheryl Sandberg, the other one. Can't remember her name. I should. Isn't that awful? She came back to work 6 weeks after giving birth and had a nursery installed in the office next door to her.
It's commitment.
No, I don't think it is.
Okay.
That's going to annoy me what her name is. She's blonde.
It's the reason I got cats. It's because there'd always be an excuse to have to come home.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I've never had an animal, really. I'm becoming increasingly interested by dogs. I think in my mind I'd quite like to have a dog.
You're lonely.
No. I live by myself, but it suits me absolutely fine.
Does it?
Yeah, I love living by myself. Mm. I like having...
Who are you trying to convince?
Huh?
Are you trying to convince?
Well, it's very difficult to convince people, especially sort of more elderly family members, that I don't go home and shut the door and cry every night. But I don't.
You do some nights, though,
right? Everybody cries sometimes.
Everybody hurts.
I like sort of chaos out of home, so I like working in sort of busy, noisy environments. And then I like coming home to absolute peace and quiet and shutting the door and not having to listen to anybody.
Yeah, it's nice to be able to walk
around. So actually, Streatham is very good. I boast that Streatham is nicely boring, but it is.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
And on that note.
Good. Well, I think we've covered everything.
I think we have. We haven't covered the last thing on my list was unisex toilets.
Would you like to quickly say why?
I just hate them. I feel like a ladies' loo is like my own and other ladies' private space, and it just feels wrong to have a share a bathroom area with a man I don't know.
Big stinky man.
Yeah, I'm very odd like that.
It's not that odd.
I'm not particularly prudish or anything, but I just find unisex loos awful.
What do you think men are going to do to?
I don't know.
Shit all over the walls.
Oh no, it's not. It's not so much the hygiene aspect. Men's loos are a little bit grubbier than women's ones.
But a man might hear you wee.
not even that. It's even stuff like when I come out and I sort of check my hair in the mirror or whatever, I feel like I'm being invaded.
Hmm.
I just don't like it.
Some guy who's hair drying his balls right next
no.
to
him. No. No, I think...
That's what we do in the loos, by the way.
Is it?
Yeah.
But I think in that kind of public space, it is a bar or a restaurant, it's our own little private retreat.
Hmm.
And I don't
think
it should be...
You can gossip about the boys in there.
No, not even that. I just don't think it's a line that should be blurred.
All of my knowledge about toilets comes from Ally McBeal. And they had a unisex
yes,
toilet.
They did, with short doors, so you could see people's feet.
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah,
I'd totally forgotten about
see
that. There were some good characters
that.
In that show.
Well, Katie, how do you feel at the end of this?
How do I feel?
Purged?
It's been... No.
Catharsis?
It's been a bit like leaving a very, very long answer phone message, and that as soon as I leave, I'll remember all the things that I meant to say.
Mm. And all the things you did say that you
regret. And all the things that are going to go out into the public domain.
Like the things about the Malay slaves that you had.
Huh? They weren't slaves.
The slaves.
They were family members.
It was a portmanteau.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well,
You're so going to run with that, aren't you?
Pretty much. I'm going to be like slave owner Katie Lane is my guest this week.
Hmm.
Listening to Ollie Bettesworth's downloadable weekly podcast programme with our guest, slave owner Katie Lane. As I said, please do join us for Crown the Knave. Our seventh night running is Tuesday, 21st of April at 7:30 at Mughouse. That's 1-3 Tooley Street, SE1, 2PF. £3 entry. That's tomorrow night at the time of recording. We have a terrific lineup, including new act of the year finalist Jay Cowell. We've got Woolwich Grand Theatre King of Comedy winner Tom Holmes. We've got me old mum, Janet Bettesworth, who is a tremendous comedian in her own right, as well as the implication being there that I am a tremendous comedian as well. We've also got David Jesu Darson, a very funny man and a friend that I have not seen in ages, so very much looking forward to that. And rounding off the bill, we have Naomi Cooper, who is a comedy badass, in the words of Jeff Garlin from Curb Your Enthusiasm. But that is not all, because our special guest star tomorrow evening is Lynn Ruth Miller. She is a stand-up comedian in her 80s. She holds the honour of being the oldest performing stand-up comedian on both sides of the Atlantic, and Kate Copstick of The Scotsman says, "This woman is sharp, and in among the fun and shtick there were some killer lines. Ms. Miller is a poster girl for growing old disgracefully and looks to be enjoying every second." I am really looking forward to tomorrow night's show. I will be the MC, but if it's too late for you to join us tomorrow night, please do join us another time. We're there every 2 weeks at Mug House by London Bridge. Your favourite podcast is back, guys. Isn't this tremendous news? And there's only more to come. There's lots more to share with you this series. And the next episode will be with Toby Morishana, who is an American comedian who travels all over the place doing comedy. And whenever he's in the UK, make sure to catch up with him, because he's a very funny guy, a very interesting fellow. Lots of great opinions. He also took me up on the secret alternative format of the show, which is popular opinions with which you take umbrage rather than loves and hates, which I always find a little bit more interesting, to be honest. Maybe I should stop giving people the option and just make them do as I fucking say. But for now, thanks for joining us. And as usual, you know, I'm going to beg you to leave ratings and reviews if you've enjoyed the show on the iTunes page to help us reach other people. You're not going to do it. None of you are going to do it. But, you know, I like to say it at the end. Anyway, it makes it sound... it makes it sound desperate, really, doesn't it? Bye, guys!
Starfuckers.
Starfuckers.
Do you know what a starfucker is?
Someone who's so good at fucking that they...
They get gold stars.
They get gold stars.
No, it's people who sort of suck up to, and again, not just in comedy, but people who will suck up to only to people who are more important than them.
Mm. Maybe those people just find the stars sexy because of all their
power. Well, that's it.
Maybe there's something not manipulative about it. Maybe it's just genuinely like, mm-hmm. oh, this person's a bit of all right because they're so confident.
Because they're so successful, immediately find them more interesting and attractive.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
Don't know.
Why would you want to fuck a loser?
That's a good question.
Hmm.
I will always make a point of sort of looking into things which are, you know, sometimes in my view, inexplicably popular, such as Kardashian and all of those. Have you ever watched that?
No.
Oh, it's horrifying. It is genuinely horrifying.
Keeping up with the Kardashians.
Yeah. Kardashians are just dull. They don't say anything. They don't do anything.
They've got nice bums, though, I've heard.
Oh, no, she's had it. It's definitely a fake bum. It's a very old-looking bum. And I'm not really sure.
But I like a large booty.
But this is quite an... Have you ever looked at it?
No.
It's unfeasibly... It just doesn't... It doesn't belong on her body.
It's like Iggy Azalea. Have you seen Iggy Azalea?
Yes.
Have you noticed that having a bum...
Yeah.
Having a bum
mm-hmm.
in pop music...
Yeah.
Used to be a bonus.
Right.
Used to be like... I have a song, a pop song,
yeah.
it'll be about sex or
yeah.
love,
mm-hmm.
and you get to look at the bums,
yep.
surreptitiously,
not the boobs.
Sort of pretending that we're looking at the bums and the boobs,
uh-huh.
of course, kind of going to look at the boobs
yeah,
as
yeah.
well, don't neglect them, but now,
yeah.
it's no longer, there's no excuse, it's just about the bum,
mm.
so Nicki Minaj has come up with this song Anaconda, and it's just about having a large bottom.
Right.
It's the entire thing.
Okay.
My anaconda don't want none unless you got buns, hun, etc.
Okay.
Then there's Booty that's come out with J-Lo and Iggy Azalea. And it just goes, big, big booty. Yeah, you got a big booty. And that's it. It's just them shoving their asses into the camera for about 4 minutes. And then it finishes. It's degraded.
I haven't seen it.
Now it's just all about the celebration of the arse.
Okay.
It's not even pretending anymore. I liked it back when we could all pretend that we weren't looking at the bottoms.
What were we looking at, though?
We were looking at the bottoms. We just weren't saying that we were looking at the bottoms.
Okay. I'm trying to think what people used to look at before...
And then The Guardian writes an article about how appreciating big bottoms is cultural appropriation, etc. Just becomes...
Didn't someone write a song about that very subject 20 years ago?
Yes, but that was still when big bottom appreciation was on the fringes. He was very much ahead of his time. So Mix-a-Lot.
Yeah.
Mm. He likes big butts and he
cannot
lie.
You other brothers can't deny it. In fact, Spinal Tap wrote a song called Big Bottom 10 years before
talk
that.
Talk about mud flaps.
My girl's got 'em.
Mm. Mm. Mud flaps.
Yeah.
It's not attractive.
No, not really.
I prefer Nicki Minaj's way of doing
it. The bigger the cushion, the sweeter the pushin.
Mm. Mm. That's very much true.
Big fan of that, I am.
Mm. Okay. What's the worst New Year's you've ever had?
The worst New Year's Eve I've ever had was probably, in fact, almost certainly the Millennium Eve when my friends and I went, oh, I can't believe we did this, into the centre of London, and I saw a woman getting punched in the face by a man she didn't know.
Oh, my God.
And her face was bleeding, and I think she spat out a tooth. It wasn't really very nice.
Did you do anything?
What did we do?
Did you just stand and laugh?
What does one do? It was such a sort of a vortex of time that you almost didn't know what to do. It's like a sort of suspended moment.
A vortex of time?
Yes.
That's a strange thing to say.
Why did I just say that? What I meant is sort of suspended reality. That's what I meant.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were some police. There must have been some police around. Yeah.
But it ruined your evening.
Yes, it was genuinely upsetting.
Mm-hmm.
To see anyone get punched is not very nice. To see a woman get punched by a man she doesn't know, or a man she does know.
So, how did you know they didn't? He just turned around, gave her a wallop.
I think so. Oh, I can't remember.
Don't know what the dispute was.
No, mm-hmm. But it was unfun. So, yeah, we won't be repeating. Well, I won't be around for the next millennium anyway.
Not with that attitude.
No, I know.